I'm Massimo Bottura.
This is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Hooney Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs.
The universal space that we chose as our universal meeting point, the table is what was decided for that. That's the way it is around the world. And that table might be different. It might be in a field sitting in a circle. It might be a long table in Italy. It might be a business meeting. But when we decide to sit, when we decide to converse, when we decide to exchange as humans, we pick the table. And I've always been obsessed with that idea that it's almost a sacred space.
The date is May 28th, 2020, and that is Ryan King, our guest on this special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is a special report of Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman. As always, our great thanks to Sam Pellegrino for covering the production costs of these special reports. We wouldn't have been able to deliver them to you without them. Our guest today is Ryan King. Ryan is the editor-in-chief of Fine Dining Lovers, which is an online magazine devoted to dining worldwide. It is by Sam Pellegrino and Aquapana. Sam Pellegrino, of course, is our promotional partner here on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Fine Dining Lovers recently conducted a two-part survey. The full results are available on their website at finedininglovers.com. I will also, of course, link directly to the survey results at the episode page for this show at andrewtalkstochefs.com. But it was a two-part survey that I thought was really interesting, so I invited Ryan on the show. The survey is titled the Coronavirus Restaurant Sentiment Survey, and I love the word sentiment in that title. And it's a two-part survey. The first part involved canvassing approximately 8,000 restaurant diners worldwide, and the other part canvassed approximately 2,700 hospitality professionals worldwide. Those are obviously the people who represent the two sides of the hospitality equation. Those are, to be honest, the two constituencies that Fine Dining Lovers, the website, services on a daily basis. I thought that the survey offered a moment to invite Ryan on the show to talk about the results, to talk about what insights they offer about where things are right now with restaurants and where things are headed as we hopefully start to come out of this crisis that we've all been in worldwide. And it was interesting to me to take the emotion and the anecdotal nature of all the prognosticating that each of us has been doing on our own and actually just get into some hard data from a pretty big sample size. I'm not a statistician, but 8,000 diners and 2,700 hospitality professionals obviously seems like a lot of people to have been in touch with. So I wanted to have Ryan on to discuss those results. And also, in the good timing department, this week, Fine Dining Lovers on their website hosted a forum where they spoke to a number of some of the real thought leaders in the restaurant industry worldwide. That was called Turning the Tables. And those conversations are also part of what Ryan and I discuss in our dialogue. And those are also available at finedininglovers.com. And I will also link to those directly from the episode page for today's conversation at my website at andrewtalkstochefs.com. I don't really think I need to say any more about it. It's a lengthy conversation by the standard of these nightly specials. So with that, I'm going to get right to my conversation recorded just this morning, actually, with Ryan King. Ryan, before we talk about these surveys, can you just briefly, in your own words, tell people what Fine Dining Lovers is and your role there?
Fine Dining Lovers is an online magazine. We speak about the world of gastronomy, about chefs. We speak to two distinct audiences. We speak directly to the chef audience. We speak a lot to experts and people who work in food and beverage. At the same time, we also speak to what I would say is a distinct level of foodie, the person who is very curious about food, the person who would plan a holiday about food, a person who is actively looking to try new experiences. And what we try to do is just play an active role in being the bridge between those two communities.
You know, it's interesting to me because you and I have, well, we met during this crisis over the telephone. We both, in our own way, as much as one can from your home during a lockdown, have had a bit of a front row seat to this lockdown and its effect on the industry. But to me, what was so interesting and why I was so glad to see you all did this survey, and I should say it is called the Coronavirus Restaurant Sentiment Survey, is that, you know, everybody's experience, everybody's perspective, even, you know, chefs and restaurateurs, owners, is anecdotal. And this survey, which you had quite a high number of respondents to, is, you know, this is actual data. This is something that takes the abstract or the emotions out of it and makes it a little more concrete.
Yeah, that was always the aim. I mean, first of all, you asked me earlier what my role was here. I've worked at the website since the start. I arrived as a journalist, but previous to that, I was a news journalist. I took over as the editor of the website in January. And one of the first things I wanted to do is bring in a little bit more of a journalistic angle. At the end of last year, we'd already done a survey on kitchen culture, and we liked the, as you say, we'd taken out the anecdotal side of things. We'd taken out the emotion almost, and we'd just looked at things from a raw data perspective. And I think when you do that, it's very hard to, one, argue with raw data like that, and two, you start to look at things from a completely different angle when you express things in this way.
You had respondents from the UK, Italy, Australia, the US, Germany, Mexico, Canada, France, and elsewhere. I have to say, Ryan, if I just cut to the chase, you know, we're all, you can have these conversations with friends and colleagues about what you think of where we're headed and what this situation will mean for the industry. I am an optimist by nature. But, you know, I look in these numbers here and I'm no statistician, but I have to say some of it feels a little bit dire, although I feel like that's incredibly valuable. I think facing the truth and confronting it is essential. But how do you, just if I put it out there very generally on a top line basis, did this bring your overall mood up or down in terms of the short term forecast for the industry?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think we all realized it was going to be quite pessimistic, this situation. We've had lots of restaurants closed. It's one of the worst, you know, if you are a restaurant right now and you don't have any diners in, that's probably the worst situation you can be in as a restaurant owner. However, we've got two sets of data. So we have the data from the diners and we also have the data from the people who work in the industry. And looking at both of these together, I think you can find some positives. You know, I agree there are originally some negatives. When you look, over half of the people that we asked to work in the industry fear that their financial situation will get worse over the next 6 months. So there's this unknown area of what people are looking at for the future of their work. However, most of the industry workers we spoke to are still getting paid. So government stimulus packages have kicked in. They have worked. 87% of people in the UK are still getting paid. If we compare this to the US, of course, Andrew, where you're based, this goes down a lot because, of course, we saw a lot of people get laid off quickly. So in the US, only 57% are still getting paid. Positives in terms of the industry is that, you know, over half of the people we spoke to couldn't wait to get back to work.
I was interested to see that you also inquired about how they're spending time away from their restaurants. Can you talk about that for a moment, please?
41% of them have used the time to improve their self, to improve, make themselves what they said, a stronger chef in terms of education or with creativity. And over half of the people in the industry that we spoke to innovated. And this is why I think it's important to look at perhaps what the data we got from the industry and the data we also got from the diners. So while half of them innovated with ideas like delivery and takeout, if we also look at the results we got from the diners, lots of people were getting into takeout. A lot more people were deciding to order delivery. In fact, what was interesting, in the only country that didn't show an increase in takeout and delivery during the lockdowns was France. And if anyone's been to France, I think you know it's because, you know, they really value the restaurant experience. Also positive, you know, positive things for the industry is that people can't wait to get back to restaurants. You know, most people that we spoke to said, it was over 80% of the people we spoke to said they wanted to go back to restaurants. And actually, it's the social aspect they're missing. It was 40% of the people we spoke to said it was the social aspect. So in terms of the recovery, in terms of what people are waiting to do and waiting to get back into the restaurants and get into dining, and especially when we look at our figures in terms of fine dining, because of course we would say that our audience are the people who really do like to go out, really do like to dine. So a lot of the diners we spoke to are people who would dine out, you know, more than once a week regularly. So these are the type of people that, you know, they're going to be the first people to go back out and get into restaurants. And what they're telling us is, we miss it, we're ready to go back.
So I guess that begs the question, what does ready really mean? What's going to determine when guests or customers, whatever word people prefer, are ready to go back to restaurants?
It's the safety measures taken by the restaurants and the chefs that will encourage them to go back to dining. And I think if I worked in the industry, this would be something I'd take very positively. Higher than the government, yeah? And only 10% trusted the media. Maybe we would have all have guessed that. So in terms of what it will take to make you go back to restaurants, in terms of, you know, what's the, you know, is it a special deal, Andrew? Is it, is it a Groupon voucher? Is it a bond? No, because only 20% said a special incentive would bring them back. Only 10% said the media would bring them back. However, 69% of the people we spoke to said that safety measures taken by restaurants is what would encourage them to go back. A lot of safety will be conveyed in supply chain, in local supply chain, in 0 kilometer dining, in this idea that the restaurant and the owners of the restaurant and the chefs that work there will encourage diners to come back by the safety measures that they take.
So obviously, with very few exceptions, even people who have managed to pivot are not making their usual level of revenue. Some of them are making, or a lot of them, I should say, are probably making less than 50% of what they're used to making. What are chefs and restaurateurs telling you all that they need in the way of help to endure this moment?
42% of the industry workers we spoke to said that we're going to need massive government support, stimulus packages, breaks, and reliefs to get the industry back stronger. 23%, so nearly a quarter of them, said that a complete redesign of the industry was needed. And I take a lot of positives in that. One, because I think it's a reflective number. I think it says that the industry is willing to say, okay, of course we need support. The number one thing we need right now is financial support. We've got our doors closed. However, second to that is going to be this redesign of an industry. And I link that back to the creativity. What I'm really looking forward to there is when these chefs decide to apply a little bit of their creativity that they've usually applied on the plate or in the kitchens or on their menus, and they apply it to looking at the systems that operate restaurants, that govern restaurants, that manage restaurants. And what we see is that this creativity trickles there and we see a complete redesign of how restaurants are run. Because I think it's really interesting to see such a high number willing to say that that's what's required to get restaurants open again.
I think a lot of what you just talked about in some ways is summarized in the experience of Alinea restaurant in Chicago. Now, you hosted, I guess would be the word, and produced a series of conversations under the umbrella Turning the Tables with people in the industry. One of those conversations, and those are still available. I will link to those on the episode page for this show. But one of those conversations was with Nick Kokonis, who's, I think, one of the great minds in the hospitality industry. In addition to being the business side of the restaurants most people think of as the Grant Achatz restaurants like Alinea and Next in Chicago, Nick also developed the software platform Talk. But you all, one of the people you spoke to in that series was Nick. And, you know, you talk about creativity You talk about people who are still doing business right now, what's become known as the pivot. Can you just speak a little to the Alinea experience? And Nick's been very open about a lot of this online, but they are actually, I don't know if thriving is too strong a word, but they are succeeding at this incredibly challenging time. And they're a very high-end 3-star Michelin restaurant.
You know, like when I first looked at it, I would have said the same, not thriving. But now having, you know, what we were really fortunate was that during this turning the tables talk, we actually had Nick and then he made a presentation to people. So he presented some raw data. He spoke about their experience, but overall the restaurant experience and what had happened across the industry. But at the same time, on the same panel, we also had Grant. So we could speak to him from a chef's perspective. And I think that was really interesting because Nick saw it coming first. And as you would, if you're the owner of a restaurant booking platform, the first thing you notice is people are not booking as many restaurants. So he saw the drop coming, immediately pivoted the platform to a new platform called Top to Go, which was to quickly offer restaurants the option to very, you know, using their existing staff, offer takeout, which I think is what the majority of people did. So, you know, you have very contactless pickup, or offer delivery, even using your own team to do that. So it was a very quick response, one for his own business, but two for the industry. And what's been most exciting about that is that loads of restaurants have jumped on that opportunity, and we're seeing takeout now. I think takeout's going through a whole transformation at the moment. I can't believe it. And then speaking to Grant, what you have is this meeting where, you know, Nick literally calls Grant into a room, and, you know, I'm sure everyone knows this is, you know, one of the world's most famous 3-star chefs, and everything he does is about experience, surprise, and, you know, he's over the top, he's very labor intensive, and Nick told him we need to do delivery and it needs to be $35. And you can imagine the sort of, you know, the shake that goes through a team like Alinea, who, you know, everyone in there is there to learn and cook at the height of the, you know, the top of gastronomy. And now they're looking at how do we do a $35 delivery takeout menu? Because actually they don't do delivery at Alinea. It's mainly takeout. So what they did is, you know, over the course of probably a couple of days, they transformed their kitchen, the car park. As Grant says, the car park became the dining room. So you have now what you call your outside expediter, and they go out and go to the car. They clock the person in. The window that these people have to collect food is very short, 5 minutes. And they originally, I think the first menu was a beef Wellington. It was the Joe Robuchon famous 50-50 mashed potatoes and a creme brulee. And the challenge, I believe, was to sell 500 a night. If I remember correctly, I'm paraphrasing, but the challenge was to sell 500 a night. And now they're knocking out sometimes over 1,000 a night. Grant is the only chef I know right now who is actively hiring staff. They originally started with 37% of their staff. They jumped up to around 60. Again, I'm paraphrasing from an article that we did. And then eventually they offered the chance for anyone who wanted to return. And now if you look on their Instagram, they recently posted because they're hiring.
There's no doubt about it. Alinea really embraced the creative challenge of what needs to happen right now. And they even found a way to celebrate a pretty big milestone.
It was probably one of my favorite questions was to ask during this whole talk was, so Grant, you know, I'm sure you didn't ever expect that your 15th anniversary would be done via takeout. So talk to me about it. And they fully went for it. I don't know if you saw, but they, you know, they have the world famous dessert that's done usually at the end of the meal where the whole team will come out and they will literally paint people's tables with this dessert. They drop down special mats that are all different colors. The music's blaring. There's glitter. You know, it's this whole super experience. And they decided, okay, let's deliver this. So they made a video. They went online. They showed people exactly how to do it. They went through the whole process with them step by step, which then created this direct connection with these diners at home. And what you saw is this massive uptake where people basically ordered a 6-course tasting menu from Alinea, you know, including sort of everything from, you know, short rib cooked in root beer sauce to this amazing dessert, video recipes online that they could follow so they could, you know, it's not even a recipe, they just arrange it. It's almost, I've been describing this stuff as Lego cuisine. So now the question is to Grant, is there's two questions, isn't there? Grant, what does that mean for the dessert? You know, when you reopen, does that dessert carry on? You know, that's your signature dish. If that's been available on a $50 takeout menu, is that now a signature dish, or do you have to reinvent a linear when you reopen? And also, what does it mean for takeout, Grant? How, you know, now you've embraced it, now you've gone from, you know, not just doing the, originally they went for this classic French comfort food, now you've embraced this idea, how far do you push it? And asking that to someone like Grant Akats, how far do you push takeout, is a question I never expected to ask in my whole career of working in fine dining.
Another one of the conversations that was part of Turning the Tables had to do with a restaurant team that's actually sequestered together and how they made that work for them.
This is also happening across products as well, not just takeout and delivery. Another person in the call that we had was Anna Ross from Slovenia. And Anna's got one of the best lockdown stories I've heard. She was on lockdown with her entire team. So because the lockdowns happened very quickly in Slovenia, because a lot of Anna's team is also international, and because they have the grounds to do this, they decided all to stay at the restaurant together. What do you do at day three? You're bored, you've got no one to cook for, you've got all of this perishable ingredients. But not only that, they're intrinsically linked to their food supply chain in that area. I mean, I can't remember the exact numbers, so again, excuse me because I'm paraphrasing, but I believe Anna said it's, you know, the population in their area is around 1,000 people. So it's a very, you know, they are the major restaurant, and as you can imagine, probably the major purchaser of a lot of produce that's grown around the area. So what they were looking at, and what how Anna described it, is a complete collapse of their food chain. So you had all of these farmers around for, I'll just use one example, but she's got lots. And the one that Anna used mainly was milk. So they work a lot with, you know, they've got all of these wonderful high mountain cows up there, and they collect all of this wonderful milk, this really, you know, some of the best milk in the world. What do you do with it when you can't sell it? When actually everyone who's going to the supermarket is buying long-lasting milk, the UHT milk, and the supply chains are a little bit broken and not as quick as they used to be, and restaurants that are all closed. So she sort of kind of took it upon herself and said, look, I have a team of people that are highly creative, that know a lot to do with food. We're all on lockdown. So she started lessons. And literally, these guys were doing lessons for 3 to 4 hours a day. Each person would pick a different product, and they would come in and present what they'd learned about that product. How could it be preserved? How could it be dried? How could it be added to? What could they make with it that would make it last longer? How could they maybe purchase it? How could they turn it into a product that consumers would buy? And this is the exciting thing, because it's the same idea of what Grant's doing. They're decentralizing their services. They're decentralizing what they do as people, as their techniques and their knowledge, and they're applying it to different areas in the chain. So what they did, and carrying on with ice cream, however, I will just say that, you know, they're working with about 40 different products now, from lambs to bread makers to vegetable suppliers. And then what they're trying to do with every single person in the team was given a product, and they would present on it and say, okay, this is what I think we should do with it. And right now what they're trying, you know, her goal is, and she kept saying it, is what do I do with 10,000 liters of milk? And what do you do with 10,000 liters of milk, Andrew? You make ice cream. And, you know, we all love ice cream. And that's what they did. So they set about producing really solid, wonderful, beautiful flavors of ice cream using this beautiful milk. Of course, we both know it's going to be amazing, because they have a team of 30 people applying their knowledge to it, because the restaurant's closed right now. And these people are, you know, they've spent their whole life gathering all this amazing, wonderful technique and knowledge. And I just think that's wonderful. And now she's at the level where she's actually meeting not only with the Slovenian government, but she's now in a business mode. You know, think business, she said, think business. And she's now in this mode where she's meeting with supermarkets and trying to set up that supply chain. They're selling some of these products on the Hisa Franco website, which is the restaurant of Anna Ross. And you know, the only country they don't deliver to right now is the US. And she said they're going as far as London, Finland, Sweden. She's sending them all over Europe at the moment.
A fascinating through line or subplot of this whole crisis and watching how things have unspooled is that a lot of chefs have learned different applications of their craft.
A lot of people who run restaurants and a lot of chefs, they're in this job because they trained as chefs. They didn't have training as business owners. They didn't have training in leadership. Often they're not great with profit and loss accounts. And I think what we'll see now is if they apply some of that drive, some of that motivation, some of that determination that's made this one of the fastest evolving, moving and creative industries in the world, to their business models, to applying a little bit more leadership, to perhaps taking a little bit of ownership of their own education and actually, you know, And we had another comment from the talk from a journalist from the Basque Culinary Center, and they're very interesting because they educate their students in a very unique way, which is, again, trying to get them to think about you're more than just a cook. You don't have to just work the line. So they've actually got a 1 year where they must go off and learn entrepreneurship. And I don't see this in a lot of culinary schools, but actually she made the point that, you know, her name is Sasha Correa, this lady. She made the point that you should take ownership a little bit of your own education as well. You know, she's a journalist, and she said, as a journalist, I went to school and I did the same length of degree that lots of people do to learn how to cook. But I learned how to write. I didn't learn how to run a media company. I didn't learn how to, and of course, there's a little bit of learning as you go along. But a lot of chefs end up opening a restaurant, sitting down, doing the menu, doing the creativity, doing the design of the menu, doing the logo, doing the branding. And when you speak to them about business and profit and loss accounts and business plans, that's not something that is the primary drive. We interviewed Ferran Adrià and we had a chat with him. And is this the most creative man in the world? And he actually came to us and said, now is not a time for creativity. Now is a time to apply that creativity to business management. And to hear someone like that say this, to hear someone like Ferran call for more focus on business management, more focus on understanding of business plans, of profit and loss accounts, of all of those key things that you really need to run a healthy business, I think that was a real turning point for us, because we realized that's a conversation that should be had right now. Everyone goes to culinary college and comes out with all of the skills required to do the perfect circles on the plate, to do all of the perfect sauces, to do all of the great chops that are required. However, are we really giving them the knowledge required to pivot their business? Because when I look at Grant Acatz and I look at the success that they've got, it's because they also saw it coming. It's because they also had a lot of data. It's because they're also set up to pivot like that as a business, because Nick is an ex-derivatives trader. He's a businessman at heart. And I think that that's the type of business knowledge and nouns and leadership that's required in a situation like this.
What I take from a lot of this, summarizing a little bit of what you're saying, but also putting my own sort of gloss on it, two things really leap out at me. One is how much of a role the business owners, the chefs and restaurateurs have in determining to some extent how they're going to come out of this. You know, the example of Alinea may seem very fancy for the general business owner out there, that, you know, someone who owns a smaller restaurant without that kind of three-star ambition. But I think the universal lesson of what Alinea did is that they made their peace with the short-term situation. They reinvented what they do, and they got on with it, which I think was, is to be commended. The other thing that really leaps out at me, and I personally have, this is a place where data meets with my own sentiment. You know, the 60-something percent of the dining respondents to your survey, you know, when they talk about the communal nature of being in a restaurant, you know, people are eager to get back out and have that experience again. And I think one of the great lessons for all of us, not just about this industry, but during this pandemic, is I think we've learned a little something about how humans are wired. I think we've really learned, at least this was knowledge that I didn't have just on an animal level, how important it is for most people to be around other people. I mean, that is something that we are all missing. That is something that is becoming very emotionally challenging for a lot of us. I think the number of business interactions and social interactions that in the past would have simply been phone calls that people are now choosing to do by Zoom or some other teleconference or visual platform is staggering to me. And I think it really speaks to this desire to be around other people. And so taking those two things together, I've always believed that this swelling desire for people to be in restaurants, for people to be around other humans, even strangers, I think when that meets with ingenuity on the restaurant side, when that meets with, as you pointed out again, and this is where the trust level and the relationship comes in, people having faith in their restaurants, and if their restaurants, you know, delineate or point out in some fashion the lengths they're going to make their places of business safe. I think those two factors are going to be hugely determinative in how restaurants come out of this.
I fully agree with you. I've always had this thing about, you know, they're the universal space that we chose as our universal meeting point. The table is what was decided for that. And that just, you know, that's the way it is around the world. And that table might be different. It might be in a field sitting in a circle. It might be a long table in Italy. It might be a business meeting. But when we decide to sit, when we decide to converse, when we decide to exchange as humans, we pick the table. And I've always been obsessed with that idea that it's almost a sacred space. It's still the space where I can say to you, Andrew, put your phone down and give me your utmost attention. And I can say that to anyone. Even if I've just met you, I can say, don't be rude, put your phone down, we're dining. I can't do that anywhere else. Someone can walk into me on the street right now because they're looking at, you know, catching a Pokemon on their phone. And I can't say much to them. I just allow it and I step out of the way so they don't hit me. And we're used to it and everyone is always on them. But when we get to the table, you know, there's no accident, I think, that, you know, there's a move to, a lot of people will turn their phone around, you know, we'll turn it upside down. We've decided it's a safe space. We've decided it's sacred. And that's been throughout history. You know, I'm in Milan and I think of The Last Supper, the most famous painting in the world. Well, yeah, the biggest thing in that painting is the table. And that's what everyone sat around. And I think that is integral and that will go nowhere. And whether we have to, you know, we saw it, whether we have to do that digitally and we have to create a digital one. And how many dinners have you had? I've cooked with people online. I've dined with people online. I've seen two of my neighbors set out their table on the balcony and dine together. And, you know, they're just creating that space. And it doesn't matter if that space is 150 meters apart between two balconies. They created a table for each other and they sat and conversed. And I think we'll always do that as human. That's what people miss. People miss the social space and they're eager to get back, especially within our audience who are already very eager diners, already the people that are really into going out and dining a lot.
So listen, Ryan, we've talked a lot about some very high-end restaurants, some of the most famous restaurants in the world. I don't want to let this conversation go by without also talking about a woman by the name of Jo Harris and how her story fits into this narrative. And I think it illustrates what a leveling of the playing field has been represented by this crisis. Can you please tell our listeners a little bit about that?
So we actually had a wonderful lady called Jo Harris, who no one will know in the gastronomy world, because she runs a local pub in the north of England. The population of the city that she's from is 329,000 people. And she closed on the Friday. Her whole team were furloughed, so she lost four of her chefs. I mean, it's a local pub, but they do very good gastro pub, I would describe it as. She closed on the Friday, 2 days before Mother's Day. And by Mother's Day, they were delivering all the food. They didn't lose one reservation. They do tapas Tuesdays. They do breakfast deliveries on a Sunday. And what was brilliant, what was amazing, and probably my highlight of the whole show, was to see Nick and Joe interacting and Nick offering Joe some advice. But actually Nick saying to Joe, listen, Joe, I've looked at your Facebook already and what you're doing is perfect. Okay, your audience is less, but it's the same principle. You're speaking to them, you're understanding what they want, you're providing them a service, you've streamlined your own operation because you had to, because you lost these chefs. And what, you know, what I assure these people that do that, these people that do make these transitions, that community will be there for you first when you reopen. That community will be the ones who come through the door and buy the first meals. And there's no reason why any of these new services that are launched now have to go anywhere.
Again, I am so, you know, just as someone like you, Ryan, who knows a lot of chefs, has interviewed a lot of chefs, I know for a lot of these people, they don't get the same satisfaction of doing takeaway. They miss the rush, the adrenaline rush of a live service with customers out in the dining room. I know it's similar in terms of logistics to do it for takeaway, but it's not quite the same.
You know, again, I talk about human connection. You look at how many restaurants today have open kitchen. You look at all the chef's counters. All of these things, you know, I don't know if we ever quite got it until we were deprived of it, but it's all about heightening that connection and that interaction, that energy of a live restaurant with diners in the restaurant. However, I do think people who have embraced the challenge of the moment, people who have recognized, you know what, this may not have been the thing I dreamt of doing exactly. This may not be the thing I was doing 4 months ago when I was living the dream I had for myself all these years, but this may be the thing that keeps my customers engaged. This may be the thing that keeps my restaurant afloat. And they are, as you said, they are, many of them are trying dishes they've never tried before, cooking in styles they've never cooked in before. And they're probably creating revenue streams that as restaurants come back with, you know, in most places, these mandated limits on how many people they will be allowed to seat in their restaurants, a lot of these programs are going to probably be what fills the gap in revenue until they're able to be fully functioning.
Yeah, again. Maybe step forward and say, okay, let's go past social distancing. Is it also the revenue that fills the gap that says this is how we build the industry stronger? Because, you know, one thing that's been on display and none of us need data for is the fragility of this industry that actually, you know, it couldn't, you know, a pandemic, it could have been any major event, you know, it shook the industry within a couple of weeks. And I think we realized just how house of cards it had been built. And I think what they really need to do now is look at that and say, okay, if I do have this audience, I do have this trust, and people are kicking out these massive amounts of meals. And, you know, there is an argument that Amanda Cohen mentioned in the conversation of, look, if everyone does it, then the competition gets too high. But my argument is not everyone should do that. You know, you should understand what it is that you do well, and you should do that extremely well. And if it costs $10 and it's delivered on the back of a bike, then so be it. And maybe you just do a lot more volume because the audience is there. I don't see this going anywhere because the demand is there. You know, any business owner, when they find demand and they start to match that demand and they see the profits coming in, it's very difficult to suddenly stop that. It's also very stupid to suddenly stop doing that. And I come back to this idea of, you know, for me, I love the fact that more and more people can now access someone like Alinea. More and more people can have this wonderful, take it down to the base level. There's a wonderful pastry shop here in Milan. They do the best croissants. I love it, but it's always a special occasion place because it's, you know, not near my house and it's not easy to go there. It's always exceptionally busy. They always said they couldn't do delivery. They always said it was something they would never do. On Sunday, I had a wonderful box of these pastries delivered to my house. And, you know, they made money, they kept their services going, and I got what I wanted as a consumer. People are finding their connection elsewhere right now through digital means. It's never going to replace the meeting with your friends, touch, the idea of seeing someone smile and eye contact. Of course, that will always win, and I fully agree that what I said earlier about this, you know, the table will remain our sacred safe space throughout humanity, I hope. And, you know, and I'll do my best to make sure that that's the case because I think it's a space that's really worth defending. At the base level, what they do is they provide nutrients. They keep us alive. They nourish us. They look after us. They, you know, okay, we can go intellectual and we can speak about experience and the creativity and all of the intellect and even the artistic side and storytelling. But at a base level, you know, a lot of people, food is nourishment, food is life. You know, that is it. Break it down, food is life. It keeps you alive.
Ryan, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for taking us inside some of these numbers. We will link to all of it as well as to the Turning the Tables conversations. And I hope you'll come back at a later date and join us again.
Thank you very much for having me, Andrew. It's been a pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Again, my great thanks to Ryan King for being our guest today. This is our 44th and second to last nightly special report. I will wrap up the series tomorrow. I have quite a special guest tomorrow. I don't want to jinx it by saying who it is because I haven't recorded the interview yet, and you never know if something might come up. But it's someone that means a lot to me, so hopefully that will happen today, and I will be presenting that to you on Friday. Again, we would absolutely love it and appreciate it if you would please check out our Patreon page and consider supporting this podcast directly.
The website is Patreon, patreon.com/AndrewTalksToChefs. If you enjoyed this show, please explore our archives at AndrewTalksToChefs.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Please do tell your friends about the show, however you like to do that kind of thing, by text, email, word of mouth, or social media. And if you would rate or review the show, especially on Apple Podcasts, if that's where you listen, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you to Wild Turkey Surprise for today's opening music and to After School Special for the music you are listening to right now. Please seek them out online and enjoy more of their music. Thank you to our engineer, Margaret Kelly, for mixing these special reports. Our thanks to Sam Pellegrino for making these reports possible. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please take care of yourselves. Take a breath, and we will all get through this together. See you tomorrow.